I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to Flop Culture. This is a podcast all about our favourite flops, the good, the bad, the in-between, and also a podcast that asks, what's really a flop anyway? I'm your host, Fionnuala. I hope you're really well. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode. If you haven't listened to that yet, why don't you go do that and then come back? I'll be here. Don't worry. I'll be waiting. Will we talk news? Let's talk news. Huge week for Irish artist Hozier. Andrew Hozier Byrne. He's become the fourth Irish artist ever to reach number one on the US Billboard 100 song chart with his new single Too Sweet, just 3 weeks after its release. The song came from his fifth EP, Unheard, which was comprised of tracks that inevitably didn't make it onto his most recent record, Unreal Unearth. And this is a fascinating story to me because this particular song, Too Sweet, gaining huge traction on social media. I think it's been helped heavily by this trend on TikTok in which it's kind of essentially a glow up trend where people post one picture of them kind of looking minging and then you swipe and they look better and it lines up with Hozier saying sweet. I think it owes a lot to that. Good song, I will say. I find it really interesting that the song didn't make the album because the Unreal Unearth was looking at kind of playing loosely with the theme of Dante's Inferno and the seven circles of hell. And one of those circles is about gluttony and gluttonous feelings, stuff like that. And the lead single of that album was Eat Your Young, which obviously falls into that category. So then he had these two and he just ultimately decided, oh, Eat Your Young needs to make the album. This doesn't. But now this is the one that's gotten all the success. So it's gone number one in the US, number one here, which he'd never gotten before. I think there's a misconception that Take Me to Church went to number one here. It didn't. Didn't go number one in the States. Didn't go number one in the UK. But this has. This went number one in the US, number one here in Ireland, number one in the UK, number one in Australia, number one in New Zealand, number one in Canada. Crazy. He's obviously delighted. He said it means the world. They're enjoying the song so much. Thank you all. He is now in a club with the late, great Sinead O'Connor, U2, Gilbert O'Sullivan. They're the only other artists who have gone number one in the States. Sinead obviously spent 4 weeks at the top of the charts with Nothing Compares to You in April 1990. You have U2 going to the top with Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For and With or Without You previously. And Gilbert O'Sullivan with the banger, Alone Again, Naturally, tune. Surprising though, because I kind of thought Dermot might have edged him or gotten there before him, but Dermot Kennedy, I mean, but he didn't, unfortunately. So congrats, Hozier. Delighted for you. If you're interested in all things chart kind of newsy bits, we're actually talking about, we're getting really into charts on next week's episode of Flop Culture with a specific artist that is actually name checked in this episode. I'll just leave it there, but it's fascinating if you're into all that stuff as much as I am. But we're not talking about next week's episode now. We're talking about this week's episode, which is about a little television show called Looking. Looking was a show that aimed to portray the lives of gay men in San Francisco realistically. While it garnered a dedicated fan base, it ultimately struggled to gain widespread popularity, leading to its cancellation after just two seasons. But why? Was it simply too niche? Was it not sexy enough? Was the pacing truly as slow as many critics and viewers lamented? Joining me to discuss it all is writer and nail tech, Alex Philemon. Enjoy.
Guys, hi, Alex here. Bit of a disclaimer, I have somehow managed to use the complete wrong name for Russell Tovey's character throughout this entire interview. No idea how. His name is not Stuart, his name is Kevin. My sincerest apologies to you guys. My even bigger apologies to Russell Tovey, should ever you be listening to this. Please do accept a free manicure on me. We didn't really want to re-record this because we were really proud of the end result, but yeah, hopefully it doesn't detract too much. But yeah, his name is not Stuart. It's very much Kevin.
Alex Philemon, you are so welcome to Flop Culture. How are you?
Vanilla Jones, always the height of pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Reunited after so long.
Reunited, and it feels so good to be talking to you. And I'm really excited to talk about this flop. Thank you so much for picking it because it's been such a joy. What did you pick?
Oh, honey. Well, I mean, prior to picking this, we did kind of cycle through a few, didn't we? The one which I'm really excited to come back for, hopefully, is the absolutely like crazy career of Krayshawn. For anybody yes. who remembers her, Gucci Gucci, like what a moment that was in 2011. But no, for today, I chose the HBO series Looking. It ran from 2014 for two seasons before being cancelled, which then HBO followed up a year later with Looking the Movie, which basically kind of like serves as this really lovely like feature length episode to tie up lots of the characters' loose ends. I chose this because it was, for a time, a really, really important piece of pop culture for me as a young gay man. It felt so needed at the time, and it continues to amass an even bigger fan base kind of retroactively. And this year as well, particularly, it felt really poignant because it marks the 10-year anniversary since it premiered, which blows my mind. But GQ ran this really, really gorgeous article at the start of the year, which I'm sure you can put in the show notes, can't you, for people to find.
It's a brilliant oral history of the show. It's so good.
It's gorgeous. It interviews all of the cast members about their experiences on the show and how a decade later the show kind of like continues to gain cult popularity and just amass an even bigger fan base. It's such a beautiful read.
So I had watched the first two episodes, I think, of it at the time when it was released, and I didn't come back to it. I don't think I was ready for it. I was still, I don't know how what age I was at that point, but I was like still quite young. I wasn't really into TV as much as I am now. And I remember just being like, not for me as well. Because let's be honest, I should preface this also by saying this. As a straight woman, I recognize maybe not everything about this show is for me, shockingly. Hence why you're here to fill in those gaps. But I'm interested to know when you met this show. Like, where did this show meet you in your life? You were saying you watched it at the time. Did you? This isn't a later watch for you.
Yeah, no, I did. So I can remember it first being advertised in December 2013. I was in my final year of university. I was so unlucky in love at the time. I was, what I felt at the time anyway, a pretty terrible gay. Like, I had no gay scene in which to like immerse myself. I wasn't leading this really kind of like rambunctious life that Queer as Folk had kind of really rudely convinced me that my life would be as like an adult gay man. And really sadly, kind of, like, I think I was completely whiling away the hours of what probably should have been just like the best years of my life, really wistfully thinking about like what life would be like when I graduated, moved to a city and kind of like could be part of the scene and live this really sort of like cosmopolitan life. But yeah, and then the trailer for Looking dropped. And for someone who had like grown up in a really small town and then moved to an equally as small town for university, it was just this incredible snapshot of what I thought kind of like adult gay life could be like for someone living in a city. And these real themes of like fraternity and queer siblingdom were so strong in this trailer, and showing all these characters kind of like surrounded by all their queer friends, navigating relationships, living kind of really hedonistically and freely. And it was just enthralling to me that this is what life would be like kind of in my next chapter. So yeah, I was like absolutely stoked. As someone who kind of grew up on this really covert diet of like Sex and the City and Queer as Folk and Will and Grace, this was yeah, really sort of like forecasted as being a kind of a harmony of what those three really formative shows of my life helped me to kind of like navigate and make sense of being a gay man. So I was, yeah, I was so excited. So I can remember that when it started in January, it was, and that this, it would not surprise me if this is why you dropped off. It was impossible to try and find a reliable website to fucking stream this thing off. It was completely, obviously, like, it was a really protected commodity as like a new HBO show, this kind of really glossy new franchise. And it was so difficult to get hold of over here in the UK. And Drag Race as well was the same. This was the kind of season six, kind of Bianca Del Rio, when it had really reached its imperial phase. And at the time, it can remember those were the two shows that it was impossible to try and get hold of. I mean, also sort of just like the idea for teenagers now to think that there was ever a time when they wouldn't have been able to have got hold of a show through streaming.
I know. Young children or people listening to this podcast, you don't know how lucky you have it. My God, we had to work for our television back in the day.
Yeah, like the idea that something would have only been accessible in the States but not over here is just so crazy when you think about just the kind of that trajectory that streaming services have had over the last few years. But, and I actually really wonder, something to consider is like, would Looking have garnered way more success than it did if it were to have been released now? That's a real argument, I think, kind of amongst the fandom, is that like this show was 10 years too early. And actually, if it had been released on a global streaming platform, something like Netflix or Prime, rather than just in the US, just on HBO in 2014, like, I guess you could pose that question to so many shows, couldn't you? Like, could streaming as we know it now have saved them?
I think that's one of the biggest issues with this show. I think it was just coming, it came too soon before the like real death of monoculture.
Yeah.
And it was too early for like streaming obviously people were streaming in the 2010s, but like not to the point where we are now. This would have killed, if this was released today, it would have found its own audience and it would have thrived on it, as you said, your Primes, your Netflix or whatever. But it was because it was this HBO prestige show. And look, we'll get into it. Regretfully, people didn't tune in, and the HBO boss kind of talks in that oral history, or he doesn't say it, but I think it's Jonathan Groff, one of the stars of it. He says that he spoke, or sorry, might not have even been Jonathan Groff, it might have been Andrew High, who's one of the producers on it. He was talking to one of the HBO guys and they were like, look, we do really like the show. Like, I get it, I see the potential, but I can't justify it when people aren't watching. But then there's also all these comparisons to these gargantuan shows that you've already mentioned, like your Sex and the City, your Girls, your Will and Grace. It just feels like it was kind of destined to fail in some way, like from the start, despite this magnetic cast, really beautiful way of telling the stories and showcasing the stories, and just very good writing for the most part. It's frustrating.
No, massively so. I'm sure, you know, when we kind of get to the end of our conversation and we're kind of really weighing up whether or not it was a bop or a flop, like, there are so many arguments to be made as to why this should be defended to the hilt. But yeah, we'll get to it. But it was, all I can remember is at the time, it was an absolute pain in the ass to get hold of, like buffering every 5 minutes. But instantly, I just adored it. I was captivated by these characters who all felt so fleshed out. They felt so lived in. You could absolutely understand how they were all friends. The storylines felt very nuanced. And whenever I say the word nuanced, I just feel like Evan Ross Katz.
But yeah, like, who really, also really is a Looking stan.
Oh
taste.
My God. Just, yeah, j'adore Evan Ross Katz. Like, protect him at all costs. Not that he's in danger, but just protect him at all costs. But yeah, like, it just, everybody had their own narrative. So this just, I don't know, that's very much how I felt for the duration of the show. It was the kind of TV show that for me in my early 20s, I just wanted to be part of that gang of friends. I wanted to be friends with these people. It literally was what Friends was for so many people, Looking was for me.
How does it hold up on a more recent rewatch then? Because obviously you're older, you're married, life is very different, you know what I mean? And we're talking nearly 10 years in the difference. What was this more recent rewatch like for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the series was very much kind of like hyped up as being like the gay man's answer to Sex and the City. So it is, for context, for anybody kind of listening who hasn't watched the series, doesn't know anything about it. So it's set in San Francisco and it is centered around three main characters, all of them gay men, Patrick and Augustine, who I believe are in like kind of their late 20s in the series, late 20s, early 30s, yeah. And Dom, who is, I think in the first series or second episode, he's 39 turning 40. So there's kind of that whole sort of storyline. So yeah, character-wise, so I'm going to talk a little bit about them, and then I want to get your 10 cents on them, because honestly, guys, mine and Fanula's WhatsApp chat chain had me creasing.
I have thoughts on these men.
These last few weeks, literally, like I would be like halfway through it. For context, I'm a manicurist. Well, so when I say client, that's the kind of client that I'm talking about. But I'd be halfway through like doing a client, and literally, I would just see on my phone screen a barrage of notifications from Fanula, and like the most recent would be like, no way, I think I hate Patrick the most. Just the stream of consciousness I was absolutely living for. But yeah, so Patrick, played by Jonathan Groff, who Fanula's previously mentioned, is this very realized character of kind of like he's quite kind of bookish, very prudish. He's a video game developer. He wants to be in a relationship, but he doesn't really know how to do so. And there's this really interesting line, I think it might have been in the second series, where Patrick says to Augustine, I think, like, I don't think we're very good at being gay, which I just feel like encapsulates so many of these storylines so well. But yeah, he's never been with somebody for more than about 6 months, I believe. He is really sort of like afflicted with this kind of real anti-hero trope, I think, of wanting to be this very liberal, proud gay man, whilst all the while being kind of shaming, I think, of other people's lifestyles. Did you get that too?
100%. You can just see, and Jonathan Groff plays him so well, and it's frustrating to watch him kind of work things out in real time with his like kind of internalized homophobia to a degree. And as you said, like looking out at others and being really shamey, but at the same time kind of wanting to fully embrace his life and his loves. And just like, there's so many just gnaw at your hands. And I actually remembered it from, because I think I made it as far as episode 2 on my first watch, when he first gets with Richie, and there's the whole conversation around like, I've never been with someone who's like not circumcised, and watching them, you know, when they're first getting together again, and I'm like, shut up, Patrick, shut up. Or like the Halloween party in season 2, where he's in a really difficult position where he's like kind of in love with two people and neither of them want him, and then he's like rinsing all his friends out loud because he's drunk at this Halloween party. I was like, we've all been there, but Jesus Christ, shut up. Like, oh my God. Just...
Guys, I'm having to muffle my laughter in the microphone. The fever
like, dream. Anti-hero is the best way to describe him, 100%. Because like, all you want is the best for him, but you're kind of like, Patrick, like, why do you keep doing shit like this?
Yeah, he is a massive self-sabotager. He wants to think of himself as like really in touch with his sexuality and very sex positive, but he also has this very kind of almost like quite prudish germophobia surrounding sex as well. Like, you know, so he gets quite kind of like bottom shamey at times, and he's chronically very interesting kind of nuance to his character is he's chronically paranoid about contracting HIV. So clearly there's some kind of, you know, past trauma and just kind of like worry about, I think he even says, you know, the reason that I didn't have sex for so long was because I thought I was going to die, which is such a crikey God, does that like, you know, hit home. But so he has two main love interests that he kind of flits between, one of whom is his boss, Stuart, who is played by Russell Tovey, played brilliantly by Russell Tovey, who is quite uptight and spends most of the series kind of in a relationship. So there's all sorts of ambiguity surrounding this will they, won't they with him and Patrick. And then Richie, played by Raul Castillo, who's so much more laid back. Interestingly as well, I thought, despite like, you know, Richie talks about being from this very kind of like working class, like Mexican, you know, sort of devout Catholic background, traditional Latino background, but yet he seems the most comfortable with his sexuality, I think, out of any of this, like the main roster of characters. So yeah, so across these two seasons, Patrick is kind of ping-ponging between these two guys. Patrick, Stuart, Richie, Fanula, thoughts, go.
Stuart, I mean, Russell Tovey, they could never make me hate you, even though what you're doing wasn't very tasteful, as Nicki Minaj says. But that Stuart character is just, it's really difficult because their chemistry is absolutely off the charts. And that's the one thing I will say when we get into kind of critiques of the series overall and the differences between season one and season two. Like, season two is so sexy and they have so many like sexy moments. But he's such a frustrating character, especially towards the end where it's just like the manipulation is off the charts. But then again, you're watching Patrick kind of walking himself into the situation where it's like, baby, you endanger girl, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, and then Richie, but then also like Richie, sweetie little Richie, played so brilliantly by Raul Costello, as you said, and he talks about the chemistry that he had with Jonathan Groff, like kind of from the off in that GQ Oral History. It's so good.
Because Raul Castillo is just straight as well.
Yes, and I will come back to that. It's him and Frankie J. Alvarez who plays Augustine, which we will get to him as well. Needless to say, we will get to Augustine.
I'm rubbing my fingers together like Mr. Burns right now because I cannot wait for the dirt to be dished.
Then, Richie is a frustrating character then as well because it's like, well, number one, why are you getting a Brady? Beyond the fact, girl, I know, I get it. I'm getting married to a ginger. I do get it. Brady is a fucking drip, okay? Let's be fucking real. But also, I don't know, I feel like he kind of loses his resolve a bit in season two, whereas like in season one, he's very like, Patrick, you do not have your shit together. I'm not letting you treat me like this. Bye-bye. Mm. Sort your shit out. And then just to kind of see him melt, slowly dissolve from season two to the movie because maybe he realizes that Patrick is the love of his life. I don't know. It's true. But like Richie's the obvious one. You know what I mean? Like I don't think you're ever rooting for video game stupid fucking Stuart who doesn't know, you can't make his fucking mind up. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Were you ever?
No, not at all. Oh my God. I do feel like, I mean, they all, and we will absolutely, I mean, to be fair, as we're going to go through characters one by one, we will have an absolute, they will all get annihilated one by one, with the exception of Doris, who I cannot wait to get to Doris. But
Queen.
Oh my God, a queen if ever we've known one. But yeah, I think the Stuart is in some ways kind of like the worst character out of all of them, as in because he's so well played by Russell Tovey. But oh my God, Richie is just like a golden retriever. Like, you just want to like bury your face into his like gorgeous golden halo of fur.
Even when he like first, when him and Patrick first interact on the bus and he's so like, he's got that swagger and that confidence, just go over to him on the bus and just be like so flirty. Oh, it's just such a little cutie. And we'll get to our highlights or whatever, but just that episode in season one where, like, I love a good episode where it's two love interests getting to know each other and they're just walking around the place. I'm like, oh, hook it to my veins.
You best believe that I've made TV trope. Absolutely.
Hook it to my veins. talk to me about Patrick's two kind of main friends that we meet as well, Augustine and Dom.
Yeah, so Augustine, he is Patrick's housemate. Bewilders me why Americans call it roommate. Like, you're not living in the same room. Like, housemate just makes so much more sense, right? Flatmate? Americans always say roommate, which, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, Americans, tune in. Flopculture@gmail.com, is that what it's called?
HelloFlopCulture@gmail.com, correct.
That's the one. So Augustine is this kind of struggling artist who appears to be having a bit of an identity crisis and in the process just sort of blows everything in his life up. He is really sort of like stuck in this cycle of, again, sort of like self-sabotage. In the first series, when, whether it's his job or his relationship, just... yeah, some very questionable choices. So series two is all about Augustine really kind of connecting, I'd say, with his queer identity and trying to find something more deep and meaningful in his life. Fionnuala, Augustine, thoughts?
Augustine in
the deep exhale was all you needed, guys.
My God. Really frustrating, but again, speaks to how good this show is because... the characters aren't all like immediately likable. They're, you know, like you're struggling with them. They're flawed. You know, you're screaming at them one minute, you're rooting for them for the next. Like Augustine, I found so difficult in that first season. It was unlikable. Clear. Yeah, so unlikable. Like didn't really even seem to be like a good friend. That whole debacle with Patrick and Richie and they're all just, you know, he's trying to bring Richie into the group and Augustine is just being like clearly not dealing with the shortcomings in his own relationship and the shortcomings with his own job and stuff like that. Like, it's just a frustrating watch. But then season two gets a haircut, transforms his life. Immediately, I'm like, sold, on board. We love it, girls. We love Augustine. But again, I will say, I would have liked to see, now the movie does rectify this, but his storyline is kind of left off fairly quickly in season two, which I was a bit like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I was like, where was the nice ending for my Augustine in the end? But we did get it in the movie, in fairness.
We did get it in the movie. Yeah. I mean, just the transition between kind of the end of season two, where obviously, you know, HBO knew that it was cancelled, like knew that it was kind of like that, that was going to be the end of the road. And so, that transition to then the movie, which is, you know, it's 80 minutes long. It's kind of basically just like a feature length episode, but it ties up lots of loose ends really, really nicely. But it does mean that if somebody was almost like didn't have access to looking the movie, it would just end so abruptly. So yeah, I think as well, I mean, absolute shout out to, is it Daniel Franzese? So Damien from Mean Girls.
Yes.
This was like an absolute, I feel like it was like the first time that I'd seen him in anything past Mean Girls. But yeah, I mean, he really is the cure-all that this needed, clearly, because his character is just delicious.
Yeah. And speaking of delicious characters and delicious food, Dom, Murray Bartlett. It's interesting because I think initially Jonathan Groff was considered like the breakout of this show because he transitioned from theatre and Broadway to Glee. And like that had been kind of splashy. Yeah. I know, Glee. Let's not talk about the Jesse St. James at all. Please, we don't have enough time, Alex. I wish we did, but we simply do not. But now, like, Murray Bartlett is an Emmy. Murray Bartlett is like kind of prestige TV 101. And he says in that GQ oral history, which, sorry, we're going to keep referencing, he was in Cairo or something with a partner at the time who was working on something to do with the Arab Spring. He talks about it in the GQ oral history. But he said at that point, like, he was kind of ready to sack acting in. And I'm so glad he didn't, because what he brings to Dom, even though essentially his entire plotline is, I want to start a Nando's in America, which I text to you. Like, he's obsessed with Peri-Peri chicken. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. He brings so much to Dom. I think there's such good representation and good faith in him, and that he's like an older gay man, and he's kind of having a bit of an identity crisis in the fact that, you know, there's an idea that people have of old gay men and then being kind of, and that he shouldn't be acting this way. Like, he is a star. He is just a star. And I'm obsessed with Dom, and I'm obsessed with Dom's friendship with Doris, who we will get into as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So Dom kind of like makes up the final sort of part of this trinity of friends. And it really was kind of like the beginning, I'd say, of like the Renaissance. Should we call it Renaissance? The Bartlettissance? Yes. Like, I feel like this was the point at which I think the only thing that I'd seen Murray Bartlett in prior to was he was in an episode of Sex and the City without facial hair. So like, so easily like missable. But yeah, honestly, just to think about like the trajectory of his career kind of beyond this point. So yeah, he's a little bit older than the other two. I think that the storyline is that perhaps maybe him and Patrick like hooked up at one point, and then he's kind of, you know, kind of like fallen into their friendship group. But Dom's storyline is mainly about him kind of navigating life as a gay man in his 40s. So, you know, you kind of see him going sort of on this real war path of having this appetite for very kind of like young, quite impressionable sort of like younger men, obviously to try and satiate this, I don't know, kind of like appetite or this desire that he has to feel young still. It touches on like ageism and discrimination that the older men face within the kind of gay community. And it's also like, it's very interesting because there's this feeling that, well, Dom kind of has this feeling that like he should have his life together by this point, but he's still sort of like waiting tables at the same restaurant that he's been at for 10 years and kind of, so yeah, so his kind of from the end of season two, in end of season one into season two, it's all about him kind of like wanting to go his own way and forge, yeah, a new career for himself, essentially, which is basically setting up the San Francisco equivalent to Nando's.
I'm obsessed. I'm absolutely obsessed.
Yeah,
do you have any kind of standout moments from the show that you love, that you always kind of come back to and think about as like, wow, this should have gotten more heat. Like, it's just a brilliant little show.
I'll tell you what, I'm gonna put a pin in that, because we did touch on it before and we promised we would get back to it, but we cannot not mention Doris.
Let's talk about Doris. Doris, played expertly by the amazing Lauren Weedman. the Dom's friend. They'd previously been together, like childhood friends. They're living together now. She is the, like, the gay best friend, the gay best friend, the archetype.
She is the, I'd say she's like the only kind of like female main cast member. She is so searingly funny. Inarguably, I would say, like, the most beloved character in this series. I mean, considering as well, this is, I think it's considered like a dramedy, I guess. Like, you know, but it's not funny in like a budumts punchline way. But no. Doris knocks out corker after corker after corker. Like, it is fair to say that, like, all too often, these, yeah, like, these three gay guys can be pretty detestable. But Doris is just this complete paragon of virtue. She can honestly do no wrong. It is such a spectacular performance by Lauren Weedman. And in this GQ article, there's this really, really touching, but also quite heartbreaking part where she's being interviewed and she shares how so deeply proud she is of her male castmates and everything that they have achieved in the wake of the show. But she goes on to say how, in some ways, quite painful and how difficult it's been that she just never took off in the same way. And the heartache that that's caused her. And Russell Tovey actually adds this really, really lovely part where he says, he was like, this show essentially like should have catapulted her to superstardom. I think he says, it's a crime that she isn't as big as Jennifer fucking Aniston, which is, ain't it the truth? Like, I just want everything to happen for Lauren Weedman. Like, she truly is the goddess amongst men.
True, especially when you consider, when we're talking about like moments we loved, I have to talk about the funeral episode in season two when Doris's dad dies. And it's kind of like, it's essentially a road movie episode. Like, they're on the road. It's her and Dom obviously go back for the funeral and Patrick goes along. For some fucking reason, I would like Patrick again that episode. I'm like, you're making it hard for me. You're making it hard for me. Like, he's just in the car and he's like, hey, Doris, thanks for letting me come along to your dad's fuck off.
Yeah,
go
I know
home.
It has nothing to do
because
with
you
me,
can't get your fucking head straight with who you're having sex with. It's beyond. It's beyond. But the performance she puts in that episode and shows like the range of her performance, especially again, you learn in that GQ oral history, she's in the midst of a divorce or like a separation from her then husband, and a really good friend had died at the time. And she said it was just like, it was, but it's, they're all fantastic in that episode. Even like, Dom is a moment where, you know, he's thinking about the fact that he never came out to his father. So they go to the graveyard to find the grave and then they can't find the grave. And they're obviously feeling really guilty about that. And so they do this thing where it's like he's coming out, but he's shouting out of a car just in the graveyard to be like, hey, I'm gay, dad, blah, blah, blah. And then they end up crashing the car. Comedy. It's a perfect episode of television. Like, truly.
Absolutely is. Yeah. And I mean, I've got a few kind of like, choice favorite moments, and I'll make sure that I talk about them all, but one of them is from this episode. And there's this, basically they're kind of staying in this sort of like middle of nowhere motel just outside, I guess, of like the kind of like one of those classic sort of like highway motels that are just outside of the town where Doris and Dom grew up. And I think they're just like they're splashing about in the hotel pool. They've got KFC for dinner and they just decide, like, should we just make the most of the situation, just go out to this dive bar? And so the three of them just like a sat at this bar. It's an absolute like armpit of a location. And then I think it's Walking on Sunshine by Casey and the Sunshine Band comes on. And this dance floor is completely empty apart from the three of them. And it is just such a beautiful, I think like enactment of friendship about how like, clearly like, you know, one of them, their dad has just died, going through a terrible time. And she's got she's bookended by these two friends who are just willing to take her out to drink shit, cheap beer and dance like no one's watching on this dance floor. It is just such a unbridled joy in this scene where they're just dancing to, Walking on Sunshine. But no, I mean, to come back to what you were asking before about kind of, you know, favorite moments, there are so many, and I think the first one that really does kind of come to mind is one that you touched on earlier on, which is, I think it might be episode like four or five, I think, in the first season. And it's where essentially Patrick and Richie are just kind of getting to know each other. I think Richie convinces Patrick to skive off work. And obviously he's this really kind of like buttoned up, very quite kind of, you know, every I is dotted and every T is crossed kind of guy. So skiving off work is so out of the question for him. And they just have this like euphoric day roaming around San Francisco. They get amazing food and they just kind of like amble the day away, getting to know each other. And I don't know, it feels so real to me, that amazing feeling of like the real kind of honeymoon phase when you're just getting to know someone and you're like, I don't know where this is going, but I don't really care because like this just feels so much fun and I'm willing to do whatever I can to just keep up that feeling.
Mm. And they're talking about like bottoming and stuff like that, but it's not seen as like, oh, like a joke, you know what I mean? Mm. Like it's people actually having a conversation about something that matters to them, among other things that they talk about. But I just found that was really interesting. I just wanted to go back to that friendship thing that you mentioned there, because obviously it centers on a group of friends that I mentioned. Mm. These are kind of inherently flawed characters. They're not perfect. You don't like them all the time. I think it's so reflective of any friend group you might have. And like, again, you have that thing of like, who do you identify as? Are you Patrick? Are you an Augustine? Are you blah, 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 whoever. Yeah. But again, especially for me, again, as a straight woman who has a lot of gay friends, they're the backbone of this podcast.
90% of your co-hosts on this podcast.
I mean, Alex, if they're not listening, they're guests, you know? Shout out Keith McCarthy, Owen Keane, Patrick Wilson McCarthy, Alex Philemont, every other gay man I've ever had on this podcast. Thank you very much.
There is there is that meme from, I think it's Parks and Rec, and it's of Amy Poehler, and it's like, and I think it just says that the captions is at the bottom. I guess I could say I'm like queen of the gays. That is it. If that meme is not used in the marketing promo for this episode, I'll be scalped.
Noted. But just even for me on like a serious note, I just loved seeing that represented on screen, and it hammered home to me how special those friendships are to me and how much they mean to me, and those relationships and connections you have. And just to see Dom and Doris like play it, like, again, they're people who got together early on, and then, you know, Dom realizes actually not into women, lol. I don't know, it was just, it was really, I loved it. I just loved seeing all that dynamic and just kind of realizing, yeah, like it is really special what I have with my gay friends, and just made me feel very grateful for them all, including you. And it's just, it's nice to see it on screen. But again, it not be, because obviously they do have their funny moments, but the thing with Andrew High and the whole team and what they bring to this in particular, like it's so intimate and it's so true to life and real, as you said, and it doesn't feel like cartoonish or camp. You could not describe this TV show as camp. And camp obviously isn't a bad word. We love camp.
Absolutely.
But camp wouldn't fit in here, because as you said, this is, we want to see real people going through real things, and we do. And it's to be in like that intimate with them and in that surrounding. It's just, it's so beautiful.
It is absolutely gorgeous. And that, you know, that ties in really perfectly into the other favorite moment that I have is, I think it's the premiere of season two, and the three friends, they've kind of like
amazing episode.
Yeah, pissed off out to the wilderness to, at the time, Dom is going out with this gorgeous older gentleman called Lynn, who is like made his millions clearly earlier on in his life, and he's got this cabin out in the woods and it's absolutely like fucking stunning. And Doris rocks up to join them, and they somehow kind of like manage to find their way to what can only be described as like this kind of like fantasy fairy tale rave in the middle of the woods. They all take MDMA, and it is just this incredible montage of them all just dancing in this state of complete ecstasy to the soundtrack of Lost in Music by Sister Sledge. And fuck me, like I have never watched a scene before in a TV show that has made me want to like pull on my party pants, call my friends and just go out dancing.
It's visceral, like in a good way. Like there's sometimes the TV shows, it's like, it's so obvious that like the party is shit or feels so inauthentic that it's like, okay, I'm watching a TV show. With all of these, I've never wanted to go on a night out more. Whether it's that episode or whether they're doing the Halloween party or whether they're at karaoke in the movie or whatever, you know what I mean? Or it's just, oh, so good.
Oh yeah, honestly, like it's I'd say that if you were, maybe as well, you need to put a link to that video that I sent you of that montage, but instead it's the soundtrack of Rush by Troye Sivan, which just is so perfect.
It's so perfect. We mentioned earlier that not all the actors identify as gay. I think it was Frankie J. Alvarez and Raul Castillo are the only two actors. I wanted to ask you, and I know we're getting kind of serious, but we'll move back, it's fine. But I just want to ask you, what do you think about non-straight actors playing queer roles? Because again, you read this oral history, and again, they've all stayed really close, and like they are all very, they treat all the roles with a lot of reverence and gratitude, and they all came from it, obviously from a good place, because they wouldn't have been able to create this amazing body of work had they not. I think even Jonathan ended up marrying Raul and his wife last year or this summer, which was amazing. But I know it's a very divisive topic for some people. So how do you feel about it?
I think that so long as something is kind of done with respect, personally for me, but then I'm not a confrontational person.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
You know, I'm not the type of person to get on my soapbox, and I guess perhaps maybe some people might say that that's a bit of a ready-salted answer, but I think that when it comes to, I think when it comes to gender politics and gender casting, like that is a completely different thing. But when it comes to, obviously I can only speak on the experience of being gay man, right?
Like, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is something that is, you know, I would never want to speak on the experience of any other kind of, you know, facet of the queer community that I don't have that lived experience of. But for me personally, I don't mind. I guess it is the job of an actor, right? Is to act, is to embody, you know, somebody who is not you. But I can also completely understand and take sympathy with the argument that, like, you know, for so many years, you know, these roles were either not accessible to gay people, or there were gay actors that were kind of, you know, essentially kind of told to stay in the closet, and therefore kind of like weren't able to almost kind of like see themselves. We can't be what we can't see, right? And so it's so vital, I think, that we have, you know, TV shows like Looking, and we have TV shows like Queer as Folk and Will and Grace and all the rest of it. Or like It's a Sin, you know, it's so important that we see these stories. But for me personally, I don't mind if it's a straight actor. I don't know if that's the right answer or not, but for me personally, I don't take umbrage with it, because I guess it is an actor's job to act. But I can totally see the other side of the argument that, you know, it's, why should gay actors almost like kind of like have to share or feel like they're in competition with people who don't have that same lived experience?
Absolutely. From one argument to another, I know it was something we discussed over text, and we'll talk about the low ratings or whatever. One of the reasons they attribute the low ratings to is I think some critics initially found the show boring. Mm. And then another thing that kind of cropped up was that it wasn't sexy enough. What do you say to both of those arguments?
It's really interesting. There's this scene in Looking the Movie where Patrick is arguing with Richie's new boyfriend, who, as Fanula, what's your 10 cents
drip,
on?
Drip. If Brady has zero haters, I'm dead. I hate Brady.
He is such a fucking dork. And oh my God, just a complete skid mark of a human being. And Doris interjects. And again, just in classic searing Doris fashion, she says, "I love it when gays fight with other gays about being gay." And I think that this is, in essence, like, why Looking was kind of almost like doomed from the start. There are as many gay experiences as there are gay people, right? But there's absolutely those members of the community, I think, that feel as though they are doing gay right. They're doing it the right way. And any other way of being gay is perhaps maybe less valid. So when you get a show about three gay characters navigating life and love and relationships, the sad reality, I think, is that it's always bound to attract some kind of animosity from within. The call is coming from within the house, like from inside the house, like inside the community, from those people who don't perhaps maybe see themselves represented or reflected in this narrative, or they see that the narratives that are being portrayed aren't, you know, isn't necessarily like how they would have done it. So as I said at the beginning, like the promo for Looking at the end of 2013 was really hyped up as being kind of like the gay men's antidote or equivalent to Sex and the City. So everybody was ecstatic. Obviously, Sex and the City, huge gay following that, like, bar Stanford and Anthony, like, you know, only ever really like had ad hoc appearances from gay characters. I mean, we won't even talk, we're not going to get onto the bi erasure, the bisexuality erasure of Sex and the City. But like, there wasn't really a great deal about Sex and the City that was kind of really relevant to gay men, but it's all of the other peripheral bits. Like, it is the friendships, it's the love stories, it's the sensationalist kind of maximalism. It's the campness to absolutely everything in Sex and the City. And I think that people very quickly realized that into the first season that actually, it was less like Sex and the City and it was a little bit more like Girls, really, which, you know, in 2014 was running parallel to it on HBO. I think actually even Looking followed Girls, I think, in terms of the primetime slots or whatever during the week when they were broadcast. So, which also as well, by the way, I cannot wait for you and Owen Keane to get onto reviewing Girls, because please, like, there are some choice episodes. Imminent. Please imminent. Let me join you with, because I have so many opinions. But yeah, I think that there was so much hype surrounding Looking in the lead up to it that was going to be, yeah, this kind of, you know, this gay equivalent to Sex and the City, that essentially the shoes were already too big to fill, which similarly, I think, was, you know, what happened with, even just looking at like a more recent example, happened with that film Bros by Billy Eichner. Like, it was gassed up so hard as being the gay rom-com that we've asked for years, that when it came out, it was almost bound to disappoint a huge number of people, because expectations were so high that actually perhaps maybe if it had just kind of like, if it just been this real kind of quiet pitter-patter and then it had been like a real pleasant surprise. So when it premiered, the opinions were just completely polarizing. It got caught in this real crossfire of essentially not being enough of one thing for any one type of viewer. So it wasn't gay enough for gay people. It wasn't sexy enough for gay people, but yet it was almost too gay for straight people. The gay-centric references were kind of almost like too on the nose or too gauche for some people, but then for others, they were too niche and they weren't relatable. So it just felt as though the hype was so enormous that it ended up kind of in some ways not pleasing anyone and losing a lot of viewers very, very early on. And even then, like, you know, kind of, I was just whilst researching for the podcast, reading back to these reviews from 2014 now, they serve as such like further proof that this show was made 10 years too early. So I think there's one from the Boston Globe that I wrote down. Looking isn't just disappointing, it's infuriating. It offers one hopelessly out of date idea about gay life after another. All of that said, Looking is still a unique moment in gay television. So, absolutely.
That's so frustrating.
So, like, mean. Like, you know, it's like, thanks for the crumb. That, like, that kind of like tiny little compliment at the end. Like, still a unique moment for gay television, but like, it's to call it infuriating. Like, and the Boston Globe as well. So that was, you know, an enormous news outlet. Just so harsh. But then it's literally night and day, because on the other side of the spectrum, there's this really beautifully written review from the AV Club, which I think, if I'm remembering rightly, was written, I think the title of the article might have even been about why Looking shouldn't be compared to Girls, but the creators have crafted something that's bittersweet and funny, but surprisingly quiet. The show simply lets the characters hang out and try to figure out what the rest of their lives is going to be like. Looking is a series about the difference between looking and knowing, the difference between seeing someone you like and really understanding who they are, which is such a lovely, like, cerebral wrap up, I think, of the season, and totally gets it. Yeah, like, it doesn't make a massive deal out of itself, unlike something along the lines of Sex and the City, or even like Girls, you know, like, you know, Girls took itself very, very seriously. And I don't think Looking really did.
I think it was very much like Andrew was like, this is how I do things.
Yeah.
This is it. Like, it's not going to be splashy, huge camp. It's introspective. It's small stories kind of fleshed out. And like, it was that thing of, I think they felt this burden of representation of, you know, there's a lot of gay execs in the room, obviously gay cast, predominantly queer audience watching. I can imagine that was a lot of pressure. And again, Murray Bartlett talks about this in this oral history, when it's one of the few things that gets to represent a queer perspective, then everyone wants it to be everything. And it was never intended to be that. And it would have been a mistake, I think, for it to be intended to be that. Because if it was, I think people would have come back and been like, this is ham-fisted, this is, you know, this is trying to say things for the sake of saying things, or like trying to be seen to be representing everyone. And I'm doing bunny ears, people can't see that. But when people make that argument, I'm like, well, sure, that's a good thing that everyone can be seen. But anyway, but again, I would also argue that it's like, if we had gotten a third season or fourth or however long it would have ran for, you would have had space to explore all of those other themes and parts and stories that people argued weren't in the first or second season, you know, because obviously the gay experience, queer experience, LGBTQ plus experience is vast. Like, it's so vast.
And it's ever changing as well. Like, you know, even just thinking about, and I know that we'll get onto, you know, if it was to be rebooted, like what would it be like? What would it encompass? But even just like some of the kind of, I don't know, like modern day things from like, you know, over the last 10 years that, you know, gay friends of mine are dealing with, that perhaps maybe 10 years ago probably were being dealt with then, but definitely weren't being put in a TV show or being spoken about in that way. But yeah, I think it really fell foul, unfortunately, to the fact that so many people dropped off at the beginning, that essentially the narrative around Looking was, it gets good in the end, I promise. But sadly, I think it just wasn't enough to, it wasn't enough to sustain that viewership kind of into the second season, which is why it kind of, the plug ended up getting pulled.
Yeah, and it was a thing of as well, there was a time slot change towards the end. So when it debuted first with the first season, I think it was at 300,000-ish viewers, and it kind of steadily rose, and like with repeats and stuff, it kind of got up into the 600,000 mark. And then it's ironic because you get into the second season, which critics much preferred. And I think that's obvious. It's a much better season. You have more room to play with, build on the stories that you've already started in season one.
And they clearly listened to the critiques as well. I think they kind of, the fact that the first series wasn't seen as sexy enough. And as you said before, like, the second season is so raunchy. God, the film is so raunchy.
Oh my God.
So it's like they listened to the critiques that were there, and they did their homework, and they put things into place. But it feels almost like it was a bit of a poison chalice, perhaps.
Yeah, because the ratings were like steadily increasing for the first season. Second season, then you have a time slot change, which we've talked about before on Flat Culture for TV shows. That can be that can literally be a knife for some shows we did. This is a hilarious comparison, but don't trust the bee. There was a scheduling fuck up there, which meant basically the continuity was fucked. Like, and again, that's someone in a suit deciding that, and it's killed then from the off. Like, you know, it's so frustrating. Again, especially as you said, like, critically, things changed. And even now you're seeing it in like 2019, The Guardian named it as one of the 100 greatest TV shows of the 21st century, 2022. Esquire ranked it 21 on the list of the best HBO series of all time. Like, it has a really good percentage on Rotten Tomatoes. Some really nice reviews of it at the time as well.
It's like 90-something% on Rotten Tomatoes, I think. It was like tens of thousands of reviews, I think. It was like well over 10,000, I'm pretty sure, from when I'd seen.
Yeah, this is the Rotten Tomatoes consensus. Funny without being obnoxious, Looking provides authentic situations that feel universal with its subtle details and top-notch performances. Love that. So bang on. And then Keith Ullich wrote this for the BBC. Looking is one of the most revolutionary depictions of gay life ever on TV. And that's because it makes it totally ordinary. Like,
yeah,
bang on.
It doesn't make a thing. It doesn't make a thing out of it, you know? And I think perhaps maybe that was what people wanted, or what people expected, was this, you know, these grand kind of like coming out stories, or you know, some kind of like really horrendous like gay trauma. And actually, like, the reality is that these are gay men living in their, you know, 20s, 30s and 40s. Like, they have kind of surpassed all of that gay drama that typically comes with a lot of gay storylines, I think. And so, yeah, it's just a really lovely, comforting, palatable watch, I think. And definitely, this was my third rewatch. And yeah, it just feels like you're kind of checking in with friends.
I was going to say, because that is something that we actually didn't even really touch on. Like, usually gay storylines are always like trauma. And that's not to say that the characters don't go through like shitty things. They do. But yeah, even if you compare it to, have you seen All of Us Strangers recently?
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Did you like it?
Yes. And also Andrew Hay directed it, right? As well as
Andrew Hay directed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I did like it. I will say there are arguments there again. Well, sorry, slight spoilers. That film does not have a happy ending. We'll just put it like that. But there is an argument, you know, I know people who saw it and didn't really like it because their argument was like, Jesus Christ, can we not just let gay people be happy? You know what I mean? And I think, look, we'll take the All of Us Strangers discussion offline. But again, it was just this thing where we're watching a group of friends having a laugh and the world isn't fucking falling down around them because of who they love and who they want to fuck. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah. It is largely pretty traumaless, I think. Mm. Apart from, you know, Doris's dad dying. But, you know, and then they make a sensational episode out of it. So it's not even like you kind of, absolutely, there are moments that really do kind of like give you that pang of like anguish for her. But yeah, it is, like I said, it's comfortable. It is a comforting watch that it doesn't make you kind of like pity them or feel sorry for them for the fact that they're kind of going through these really like tumultuous, you know, motions in their life. It's just, you know, having said that, it's funny because I think you watch it thinking to yourself like, or I know I definitely kind of watched it in my first rewatch so I would have been 21 at the time, and you know, kind of probably at the time thought to myself like, oh my god, like people in their 30s and 40s like must just have like everything together, like they must just have like their whole entire life together. And actually, this TV show is such a kind of almost like a reality check for the fact that, like, you know, these people are still figuring out in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah. Yeah. Russell Tovey had spoken about it as well, about like the kind of critical reaction to it, and about how it kind of, he says in one particular interview that it nearly broke him. The critical narrative at the beginning was that nothing much happened in it, that it was too boring, but it was just real life. He said he was approached by someone, he was getting coffee. I think they were shooting it at the time. And they'd ask, you know, what are you shooting? And, you know, they'd be like, I've not watched it. I've heard it's boring. They hadn't even seen it. And it's about you in your city, because they shot in San Francisco, and obviously that's where they were shooting, filming outside your coffee shop, and you're not even intrigued to watch it. It really, really frustrated me. It broke me, honestly. Especially from his perspective as someone who has been out from the very start of his career. I think this might have been his first time actually playing a gay character, though. I'm open to correction on that in such a big capacity. Yeah. Am I right or am I wrong?
I'm not sure. I don't think he was out for a long time, because the first time that I'd seen him was in Gavin and Stacey. He was one of Gavin, I think Budgie or Magpie, or one of the two of them, like in Gavin and Stacey. But I feel like, I could be completely wrong, but I thought,
it's fine. This podcast is for about just being wrong regularly and me correcting it after the fact. It's hard to remember lots of names when you watch TV shows with 8,000 characters in them. Okay, guys, give us a break.
All the gays in your life, Fionnuala, I'm sure it's very, very difficult to keep that many tabs open. Who came out when? But yeah, and actually as well, it's so funny that you touch on Russell Tovey, because I think he has been, without a doubt, the most outspoken about his disappointment that the project ended how it did. I can even remember as well, I think this is also what kind of maybe inspired my second rewatch. Like, this must have been 2018. He went on Jesse Ware's podcast, Table Manners, and there is this really lovely scene in season two where they have essentially kind of like a gay prom for all these people who, obviously, you know, it is a real trope, a real narrative that a lot of kind of queer people don't feel that there is a place for them at, you know, at their prom, and so they don't get to go. And there's this really, yeah, lovely scene where Patrick and Stuart are kind of dancing to, I think it's Say You Love Me by Jesse Ware. And so that's why he brought it up on this podcast, and obviously Jessie Ware as well, just like you, Fionnuala, queen of the gays. But you know, just yeah, I think from just the kind of the little tidbits that I've seen of Russell Tovey, I think he's always been very outspoken about how heartbroken he was over the fact that this project, you know, didn't live up to the potential, because obviously it has amassed, as I said, this enormous kind of like fan base retroactively, but it didn't perhaps maybe build the momentum that it should have done.
Yeah. Let's talk about the movie. So the show is cancelled, but it ends on... It's not a massive cliffhanger. In some ways, they could have left it there. I'm really glad they didn't. But Patrick and Kevin Russell Tovey's character they're dushed. And, well, it's kind of implied that they're dushed because Kevin is kind of wants to have an open relationship. Patrick doesn't. He's just moved in with him. They've all kind of said it's too soon. Augustine is about to show off a mural he's done at the shelter that he's now working at, like after fully getting his life together. Dom and Doris are in this really interesting particular where Doris had like promised him money out of her dad's will, and that's kind of still hanging in the balance. And Dom is obviously still frantically trying to do this restaurant and kind of started things, thinking he'd get the money. So we're kind of seeing them fight, and that's obviously really torturous. But in the end, we see Patrick has this fight with Kevin. He leaves. He turns up at Richie's barbershop, gets his haircut. End scene. Obviously, everyone in 2014 is screaming at their TVs, being like, "What the fuck?" So then it's announced that they're going to do a movie and it's going to wrap things up. It's going to like be this finale. How does that work for you? Were you happy with the endings of everything? Like, what works for you? What doesn't, if anything?
It's such an interesting one. I am so glad that, as you said, all of those kind of loose ends were tied up. I think that in a lot of ways, I'd say it was the ending that it deserved. But I think 80 minutes is just such an hour and a half is almost, I would have loved for it to have been almost kind of like, I think you even said this to me over text, almost for it to be kind of like a mini series of, let's say just like, you know, 3 hour long episodes that, or even 4 1 hour long episodes that focuses on kind of like in the same way that Euphoria does, where it focuses on, I think maybe even Euphoria did it in between season 1 and 2, where they did like an episode on Jules and an episode on Rue, like an hour long feature episode on tying up every single character's, you know, loose ends, but kind of giving them more of a spotlight. I felt that the movie focused, I felt like it hinged massively off. It, essentially, the crux of it is that it takes place, I think, kind of like almost like a year later on. And Patrick has moved away from San Francisco and he is revisiting because Augustine and Eddie, played by the amazing Daniel Franzese, aka Damien from Mean Girls, they are getting married. And so, it's all about kind of like surrounding the festivities of Augustine's wedding. And I felt like that was perhaps maybe because, as you touched on, season 2, Augustine kind of did just sort of like fall by the wayside a little bit. And so it felt as though the final, the movie was kind of like a real glut of him. I don't know. I guess, I mean, as I said, I have a real sentiment attached to these characters. So I always would have loved to have had more from them. I mean, how about you? Like, what was your stance on it? Do you feel like it was, there was enough there? Do you feel like there could have been more?
No, I'm of the same opinion. And I think this is what I said in my letterbox. Like, I think it obviously brings everything to a nice conclusion, like while still being open enough. Like, we don't, like, do Patrick and Richie make it? Who the hell knows, especially with the way things have been beforehand. I liked Augustine's happy ending, but still kind of being faithful to him that he's having a freak out and he's like, actually, I don't know. And the cold feetness of it all. Dom doesn't really get a look in here, you know what I mean? With the exception of, like, you know, there's a little thing about, like, you know, Doris is thinking about having kids and but like hasn't really shared it with Dom, and Dom's kind of dealing with that. But Dom's also like, he's been pouring himself into the chicken window, that so he hasn't really been like sleeping around or whatever, or like focusing on himself in that way. But it's kind of minute in the grand scheme of things. So I do think it would have functioned better as like a short series. And I loved your idea of an episode focusing on primarily person. on each person with, they'll obviously interconnect or whatever. I think that would have been, if they'd obviously had endless time and endless money, and I think, obviously, I think they would have taken this show to the end. They would have taken this for 6-7 seasons if they could have, but they couldn't. And I do think that's what they would have done had they been able to. But I still think, like, and again, judging from, because I've been tracking all this on Serialized as well when I was watching the TV show, and again, the general consensus on Serialized was that, like, they were glad of the movie, that they had the movie to go to, and that they still had like an hour and 25 minutes to go back with all these characters and hang out. Yeah. I need to read out one Serialized review that I sent to you that I actually chortled out loud at, and I think you did as well, about the fact that they didn't believe Patrick and Richie being together, because I'll actually never say it as well as they do. Hang on.
Guys, I literally barked with laughter.
Yeah. So this person gave like the final episode of season 2 3 stars. Oh, sorry, the person is called Trans Luigi. Shout out to them. They said, Richie acting so sweet around a man with no lips is insane to me. And you know what, Trans Luigi? You're right. You are right. Oh, God. So funny. Okay, let's talk reboots then. What do you think a reboot would look like? Are we going back with the same cast? Would you do a totally new roster? Who are you thinking? Have you thought about it?
It's hard because I feel as though a reboot with any cast of characters other than this cast just would not be looking. I would definitely be curious to know what, and you know, it's so poignant, like I said, that it's 10 years on now. I would be so curious as to know, like, what these characters are doing 10 years later. Like, I'd love to know if Doris and Malik had their baby. I would love to know if, you know, Dom opened up his, what is essentially like, you know, Nando's chain, and is essentially like a, you know, the Bill Gates of this kind of Portuguese chicken dynasty. It would be, yeah, I don't know, like, interesting. I think it was a few years ago, there was a petition or like this Twitter campaign to resurrect the show. And Russell Tovey, like we said, has been very, very outspoken about how jilted he felt by it being cancelled, like acknowledged it. And he said, you know, I'm in if anybody else is. So maybe, you know, it's not outside the realms of possibility. And with this kind of like cultural consensus that this show was just, you know, a bit premature. But I mean, if they were to, you know, to reboot and start afresh, I almost kind of like wouldn't want it to be looking, I don't think. I'd want it to be more reflective of kind of like elements of almost like, yeah, like Euphoria and Queer as Folk. I mean, like, yikes, please, we have to do another episode on the revival of Queer as Folk because, yeah, I mean, absolute flash in the pan. Oh, not good? No, I think that was cancelled after one season. I think that the kind of the whole argument around that was that it perhaps maybe they kind of like dialed up the wokeness a bit too far. I'm not too sure, but I would love to see, I'd love to see a little bit more body diversity. I would love
absolutely,
to see
the
fact that, you know, I think they had, so in the first season, Augustine has a boyfriend called Frank who is mixed race. I think that Frank is maybe the only, when I say character of color, like in terms of black character of color, obviously Richie is Hispanic, but yeah, I think that there's definitely kind of like some representation that needs to be shown there. And there's a, you know, a whole conversation about kind of like racism within the, you know, within the gay community that is, I think, kind of like a storyline that a lot of people would like to see. I think it'd be fantastic to see, you know, kind of like a trans representation. So it's more reflective of San Francisco. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely kind of characters, you know, actors and actresses that I would love to see. I'd love to see someone like Trace Lissette, I think would be incredible, or Isis King, perhaps sort of step into a role like that. I mean, I would literally Jonathan Bailey, I would watch him do anything. I'd watch him open his post. I'd watch him sort. I would watch Jonathan Bailey sort his colours from his whites. So he would definitely be on my fantasy roster. I think that someone like Johnny Sibley as well, who's actually kind of like in real life is best friends with Trace Lissette. So I think they'd have fantastic kind of, you know, on-screen chemistry. But I would just love to see, you know, storylines that are just a little bit more kind of like niche or a little bit more unspoken of. So, for example, I would love to see kind of a storyline about, there's this whole kind of, you know, conversation around essentially kind of, if you're not a top or if you're not a bottom, you're a side. So essentially somebody who their stance on, they're just not into penetrative sex. And that is something that is so common within the gay community, and yet something that I've never seen explored in a TV show. I'd love to see a storyline, perhaps maybe that's about a relationship breaking down or having to try and navigate the idea that one, you know, one partner is obsessed with porn or something, and you know, nothing quite lives up to their expectation. You know, I would hope that looking rebooted 10 years later could give us something that has really got its finger on the pulse of what is kind of governing queer relationships today, and what queer people, and not even just queer people, are having to kind of like learn how to navigate in their relationships.
I know we would struggle to recast, as you said there, but did you know Pedro Pascal was almost in it? And then the casting director for Looking ended up, that didn't end up working out, but he went on to do Narcos then, which is like butterfly effect that like maybe he wouldn't be the huge star that he is.
Oh my God,
not
absolutely.
Audition for Looking, you know, crazy. Yeah. And then also Frank Ocean was approached about being a guest star at one point, but he couldn't do it because of touring commitments.
I was going to say, because that would have been just after Channel Orange, I think, wouldn't it? So
yeah.
Yeah, 2013, 2014. Oh my gosh. I mean, what could have been?
What could have been? It's such a bright, funny little show. I love it so much. It's a certified bop to me, but I suppose to go back to why we're here and the original premise of flap culture, ultimately, Alex, why do you think Looking flopped, and why do you think people should revisit it and gorge on it nonetheless?
The whole reason of why I'm here, and I'm sure as well at me announcing, or even just, you know, even just the sight of seeing in this kind of like Spotify list, HBO Looking bop, but flop rather, like I'm sure there is going to be swarms of gay men questioning why or not this is even being contested, but I will absolutely die on the hill that this is just an unrivaled bop. I think that the method was in the madness. Like I said, it was a poison chalice. I think it just fell foul of essentially being made 10 years too early. Yes, the characters are deeply flawed and not particularly aspirational. I think that there is a hilarious irony to the fact that the show is centering around three gay men, and yet the most beloved character that the fan base, you and old, would defend the hill is the one straight woman. But yeah, I can't help but return to what I said at the beginning, that this show is just, it feels so comfortable, and that with each rewatch, it feels like I am reconnecting with old friends. And so for that reason, I would just encourage everyone to go and watch it when they can.
Alex, such a pleasure. You are an amazing friend, first and foremost, but you're also a manicurist, you're a writer, you're a content creator. Where can people find out more about all of those things? Any of my UK gals that need their nails done, where can they find you and find out more?
Divas, hit me up. So on Instagram, Instagram is pretty much the best place to find me. So it's at putitinnudetral, putitinnudetral, NUDETRAL. You can find me decorating tiny parts of people's bodies for maximal happiness in return.
Alex, it's been a pleasure. Please come back for Creation soon. I'm so excited.
My darling, thank you so much for having me. Love you loads.
Love you. Thanks for joining me on Flap Culture. Thank you so much to Alex. I leave all of his links below. He's at Put It In Neutral with some full stops in the middle on Instagram. And he's a great follow if you need the nail inspo. And he's just a great guy in general. And I'm really grateful that he gave this show its proper airing on this podcast, and I really appreciate the conversation I had with him. Finally, top of flops.
You're a flop.
Top of the flops this week is this Office reboot that is currently in the works, which I just cannot even fathom, and it makes me sad because it's due to star an Irish actor, Donald Gleeson, like huge star, love him in About Time, love him in Brooklyn, love him in Ex Machina. He's great, he's brilliant. What are you doing starring in a reboot of The Office alongside Sabrina Impacciatore? She's from The White Lotus. The most recent season of The White Lotus. She's the reception. Or the hotel manager. She slays, eats the house down boots. Again, she should also not be bothering her hole with this, to be completely honest.
And I hear you. I hear the people saying, Fionnuala, it's more than 10 years after the original. Like, surely this is enough time to, you know, revisit such a beloved show. Because obviously it is beloved, both The Office UK and The Office US. I get it. I have actually never watched The Office UK and I probably never will. Should I? Let me know. helloflopculture@gmail.com. I did my pandemic watch of The Office and loved it. I think it's very good television. Very, very good television. Very, very good comedic performances. The issue is, because of that pandemic and this streaming era, The Office is still so fresh for such a large majority that I think it's too soon. It makes the time feel shorter in between the original iteration. Also, and I know there were probably arguments made when The Office was being rebooted for the US that it's like, well, it's not going to be better than the UK version. And like, it wasn't in different ways. So I hear from people who've watched both, like from the sounds of it, they're two completely different shows. There'll be people saying, well, I mean, like, this is a different iteration. Apparently, Greg Daniels, the creator of the US version of the show, has said that a possible idea would be for if Dunder Mifflin is set in the 2020s, but it's still going to following, you know, that mockumentary style. We're in an office. We're getting to grips with the workplace politics, all that jazz. Mixed cast, new faces, old faces. But I mean, you already have, in terms of people who've said, I'm pretty sure are not coming back. John Krasinski, who obviously played Jim Halpert. Jenna Fisher are not coming back as Pam Beasley, apparently. And Dwight Schrute, played by Rainn Wilson. They're not coming back, right? Which, again, I think is also fair. They've all moved on. Does it make sense even in the character's universe that it's like, why are we still here? I'm just... like, what happened to original stories? You know what I mean? You look at any of the big, good TV shows that I've been obsessed with over the last few years and they're all original stories. Like Baby Reindeer most recently, my beloved Succession, my beloved Severance, my beloved The Bear, which again is also like a workplace comedy. I mean, I know people argue about The Bear having a comedy genre tagline, but some of it is funny, okay? Like, lighten up, it's fine. Genre, as Beyonce said, it's a construct, it doesn't exist. My point is, they were all like not based on, pretty much, maybe I'm open to correction on that, but at least they weren't like these hard reboots that were just, we are in the fucking thick of it. And it feels like, and I know we've been in it for a couple of years, but it seems to be so much worse in the last year, year and a half. Like, I talk about these reboots all day long on the radio. It makes up 75% of my entertainment section where I'm talking about what are we going to be expecting in cinemas, what's coming to TV. It's okay, let's tread this old ground. And don't get me wrong, I get it. There's a nostalgia factor. It's inherently less risky. People are aware of the format, and you have this thing, especially with streaming now, that psychologically people way prefer to watch stuff that they kind of know what's going to happen. Or like, that's why you're seeing huge rewatches happening, where it's like, you need that safety and that confinement of nothing weird is going to happen here. I know exactly how this ends. I can recite it off by heart. But I just can't help but feel like, oh, this, I'm lethargic even thinking about this. And the thing was, with The Office US, it was just this lightning in a bottle of this cast. And I just don't know, especially when it's living in the shadow, this new reboot is going to live in the shadow of that. How can you expect anyone to burst out of that? Like, you just can't. Not to mention also with streaming is now totally different. Like, these long form, like long, long comedy series, workplace comedy series, like sitcoms, they're few and far between now. It's all about dramas. It's all about that prestige-y kind of, like, comedy doesn't thrive in the same way anymore. I think an outlier there is probably Abbott Elementary, which is on my list to watch. I am going to watch it. That's scooping up loads of awards, seems to be doing really well, even though it does live in it. It lives in a streaming ecosystem here. I'm not sure if it's actually on network in the States. We don't watch television in the same way that we used to, where it was like, oh, we need to see how The Office season 4 ends. I need to watch the season finale of the, you know what I mean? So then it's like, are we approaching it in that way? Is it made for streaming? Are we doing 4 episodes in May, 4 episodes in June? I don't know. It's just, I don't know. And I'm annoyed because, again, Donal and Sabrina, two very good actors. And I actually, and particularly good at comedy, I get why they wanted to do this. I get that they believe that maybe they can bring something else to this. This is fun. This is a new iteration. I'm sure there's a lot of money involved if we're going to talk plainly and frankly, has to be.
I do. The question is just always going to be why for reboots. Like, why? I don't know. Name me a successful reboot of a television show. HelloFlopCulture@gmail.com. And I'll maybe I'll rest my case. Maybe I'll eat my words. Tell me on social media. @FlopCulture_pod. Is there a TV reboot I need to have on my list? We're actually covering another comedy of this ilk reboot in a couple of weeks that I haven't watched, but I will obviously be watching for the episode. So I'm intrigued to see how that fares for me. But yeah, I don't know. Are you excited about this? Let me know. I want to be, but I can't be, and I'm struggling. I'm on the struggle bus, I'm not going to lie. Tell you where you won't be on the struggle bus, the Patreon. Patreon.com/flapculture. We have just uploaded our critique, insight, deep dive into Taylor Swift's The Tortured Poets Department. It's myself, Cian Sullivan. It's like nearly 2 hours long. We're talking about all of the public narrative that informed the record, if you're to believe in gossip columns and stuff like that. We are talking about her motivations for making a record like this. We're going track by track. We're talking about what constitutes a double album. It's a great conversation, I have to say. And also coming up early next week, myself and Carla did watch After We Collided. And we also spoke about that for over an hour. Despite the movie, it shouldn't be, like, it doesn't need to be any longer than 20 minutes. And it is, for some reason. But we had a laugh. It's patreon.com/flapculture. You get three bonus episodes a month for $4.50. You can also get the audio only in the Apple feed if you want that. But if you're in the Apple feed, you don't get shout outs like you do if you're on Patreon. So hello, Claire S. How are you? You were very nosy. You wanted to hear the Torture Poets Department review. Hope you enjoyed it. Let me know your thoughts on it. I'm really interested to hear. Hello, Monica L. Another Swiftie curious about thoughts. Again, let me know your thoughts. I'm interested. Am I wrong? Tell me, please. Hello, Emer as well. I hope you're really well. Thank you for subscribing. And hello to Kira. I hope you're well. I hope you have a great rest of week. A reminder, you can watch some of the episodes on YouTube. Just look up Fionnuala J. This has been Flop Culture, as always, edited by Adam Shanahan. I will see you all next week. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.